Hi, and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and this week I'm joined by Helen Buckingham, Director of Strategy at the Nuffield Trust, Richard Sloggett, Programme Director of the Future Health Research Centre, and HSJ's own Deputy Editor, Dave West. The NHS has been promised fundamental and far-reaching reforms by the new Health Secretary when speaking at his party's conference earlier this month. And this week, we're going to be discussing what this could actually look like when the NHS is still under immense pressure from the pandemic. I'll also be asking my guests this week which areas of reform Sajid Javid, and perhaps also Amanda Pritchard, the new NHS Chief Executive, should be focusing on. So to start the discussion, perhaps we could take a step back, and I'd like to bring you in first, Richard. You worked with Matt Hancock as his special advisor, and I'd be really interested to hear what the considerations are for a new Secretary of State when they start the job, about what to reform, what to prioritise, and is there a feeling they need to make their mark quite early on?
Yeah, hi Annabelle. It's great to be here. I think when I joined Matt in the department in sort of mid-2018, it was obviously very different times. We did have the challenge of Brexit, of course, but we also had the advantage of a legacy of cash from the previous Secretary of State to spend, which was in the 2010s certainly highly unusual given the funding settlements that the health system had. So we're in quite a fortunate position really to sort of work out and identify some proactive agenda setting priorities that we could lay down and then try and drive forward on that were aligned with what the service was sort of asking for and also what was of personal interest to the Secretary of State. So we had three areas that we sort of looked to prioritise and had, I'd say, a mixed bag of success on them. So technology obviously was a huge focus for Matt from his time at DCMS, and there was a lot of work done, creation of an NHSX, publication of a tech vision and other things. Workforce, for obvious reasons, given the real pressures in that bit of the system, and we made, I would say, limited progress in the time on that, and there's a whole range of reasons why. And then on the prevention agenda and moving more of the focus towards the more primary care end of the spectrum, I think the long-term plan sort of sets out elements of that. So for Sajid Javid coming in, he's coming in at a very, very different time. Pandemic's obviously still with us and been very much the sort of front of mind. Money has been, you know, given to the service, but in a very sort of short term, sort of service reactive kind of manner. And I think he's come in with a brief to manage the service around that pandemic and also critically to recover performance. I mean, with his first 100 days, obviously he's worked with the Treasury and with Number 10 to secure a significant amount of additional funding to you know, clear the electives and bring in a social care cap, which is quite a significant achievement in that particular period. But every Secretary of State comes in at a different time, and that is very important for then sort of determining what they end up prioritising and focusing on. But final thing I would say on the personalities here, which I think is very, very important, is I think Dev is a very, very different personality from Matt Hancock. Sajid is quite an assertive politician, quite directive in how he wants to conduct business. And you're starting to see some of that. And also another big difference was when the long-term plan money was raised, we didn't see taxes change, which I think was quite critical. The Treasury didn't have to raise national insurance to pay for the long-term plan. It has had to break the tax up here, and that brings other bits of Whitehall more to the fore in terms of direction setting. So each Secretary of State wants to make their mark, but timing is everything here, as well as their own personalities and agendas.
Thanks very much. And Helen, I saw you nodding a few times there. I'd like to bring you in. What are your thoughts on his kind of, well, Sajid's first kind of decisions he's made during his tenure?
Well, I mean, as Richard said, he's come in at a pretty challenging time. I mean, it's probably not a job that many of us would want to be in at the moment. I think it is very interesting, and Richard touched on this already, in terms of the culture and the tone that's being set, because there's a very strong message that's been coming out of the developments around, you know, first SCPs and now ICSs, which is about local accountability and local determination and a real focus on making sure that you are meeting the needs of your population. And there's a tension between that and the natural desire of a Secretary of State of what's labelled a National Health Service to be able to drive change from the centre. And I think it's going to be very interesting in the context of the Messenger review. I actually read a book review last night, which was about leadership in the British Army, and making the points about, you know, some of our assumptions we make about the army and the way that it delivers things are not necessarily true. That kind of mission command approach, which says this is the outcome that you need to achieve, but actually, and here are the resources that you've got to achieve it, but it's up to you how you apply those resources to achieve that outcome, is quite attractive in the context of ICS development. So it'd be very interesting to see how the Messenger review takes that learning, if it does, takes that earning from army leadership and feeds that back to the Secretary of State in terms of actually this is how the centre needs to operate.
Or could, you know, as our editor's Alistair's piece about this observed, you know, this some feels somewhat likely it will conclude similar things to all the other recent leadership reviews, which tend to say, you know, we need an improvement in culture, we need an, you know, more longevity in how chief executives work, we need less of a targets culture. And I think actually Sajid's already alluded to the problem with sort of targets culture, which, you know, obviously there's lots of other issues, why reasons as to why he may wish to change targets, but you know, it's entirely possible it could go in that direction. But I just wanted to ask both of you, you know, on that Messenger review thing. You know, obviously, we at HSJ think NHS leadership is like jolly important and can make a massive difference. How good it is makes a massive difference to care and outcomes. But you know, not everyone thinks it's the most important thing. And it seems a little bit odd that within the first 3 months, the Secretary of State has happened upon health and social care leadership and management, as opposed to all the other things out there, like the million other staff and, you know, all the other levers you can pull, money and prevention and all sorts of other things. You know, why do you think he might have happened upon this first, to come quite, not quite first, but come very early to talk about and to want to poke NHS leadership and management?
Shall I kick off? I mean, I think it's interesting. You can't, as a leader, you kind of have to believe that you're making a difference. And I do remember a conversation. It'd be invidious to name names, but in one of the many places I have worked where we had a trust that was quite challenged, and I was a chief exec in the system. I was talking to another chief exec in the system. Third chief exec of the challenge trust was changing, and we said to each other, do we think it's going to make a difference bringing a new person in? And we kind of looked at each other and said, well, we have to, don't we? You know, we are the leaders. But I think it is true that actually leaders can make a significant change to organisations more quickly than we think. But they are absolutely not the only thing that impacts on performance. And it's actually really important to understand the whole context in which an organisation is operating in, if you want to make a change to the performance in the organisation. So that the Secretary of State saying, you know, I can see that there are some organisations that always do well and some organisations that always do badly. And I think that the difference is leadership is a very obvious thing to say. It's a much more complex thing to get under the skin of. And again, I rather hope that the Messenger review will say that. Previous reviews have also said that, so we need to understand. We need to see how that's received, if that message is what comes across.
Yeah, just on the sort of higher politics of it, Dave. I think obviously this review was announced at the Conservative Party conference, which, you know, I don't think it would have escaped anyone's alignment attention. I think there's also an issue here with the perception that there's this phrase in Whitehall about Secretary of State that's called going native. And basically being seen to suddenly, you know, move into their departments and basically do the biddings of the organisations they're in charge of rather than holding them to account. It's a key concern the Treasury has about Secretaries of State. And this is where I think the levy is quite an important mechanism, policy mechanism, because I think that negotiation around the levy, and Sajid Javid's own role previously in the Treasury as Chancellor and in other ministerial positions, I think he's come into this position with a view that he is not going to go native, certainly very, very quickly. He wants to kind of demonstrate to those in number 10 and number 11 that he is getting a grip of these issues and bringing in outside counsel to advise him on how to spread good practice and everything else. The other thing here is the briefing versus the reality, I think, is quite interesting over what we've seen in the last few weeks. So the briefing is very, very assertive. So it's, you know, we're going to bring the military in on leadership. We're going to force GPs to do face-to-face appointments. When you look at the actual substance of the documents that's coming out of the Department of Health, the substance of the documents is pretty sensible. It's pretty balanced. The language and tone is pretty sensible. So there's a bit of gallery playing here versus what is actually going on in terms of the policy, which I think is
sometimes, Richard, a gap opens up between the special advisor speaking to the political journalist and the what actually the intention is. Is that
it has certainly been done.
Perhaps I can come in there as well. I mean, I think the messaging is really important, and Richard makes a good point there, because to some extent, politically, politicians need to play to the people who elect them. You know, we elect them, but there's quite a cross-section of the electorate. But they also need to play to the people that they are leading. And of course, the NHS, you know, you can define the workforce in different ways, but it's one of the biggest workforces in the country. If you add the social care workforce, which is even bigger, then actually you're probably touching, you know, if not every household in the country, certainly, you know, a third, maybe a half of them. And, you know, reform, plus ça change. And this is my 30th year in the NHS, and we've been reforming pretty much the whole time. But mostly it's been affecting the commissioning environment, and I've been a part of that, so I don't discount that. But actually what we're experiencing now, post-pandemic and in the context of austerity as well, is a workforce of 1.3 plus 1.5, give or take, million people who are absolutely knackered, having gone through the last 2 years, pretty knackered anyway, particularly in social care in the context of austerity, and they are hearing politicians saying, you're doing a bad job. So this is not just about the commissioning system potentially being demoralised. This is about the wider workforce being demoralised. And we've had that with segments before. You know, we've upset the consultants, we've upset the junior doctors. But
Helen, do you think, I entirely agree that, you know, many of the workforce are tired and stretched. I was challenged on this point recently, that is it actually frontline staff who are really bothered about hearing about seeing reform in the newspaper, or is it kind of like people like us and actually people in the various hierarchies and managers who are thinking, oh, this is going to make our life complicated, isn't it? You know, arguably, particularly, you know, if you think about social care, which obviously has gone sort of like terribly unreformed for too long, mainly about resources, but there's other things too. You know, a frontline staff not actually thinking, well, yeah, so we could do with a bit of reform, so if that's gonna help our lives. Maybe it's people up the hierarchies who are more worried about it.
Depends very much on the nature of reforms being talked about. So I think, you know, for most frontline staff, the creation of ICSs as we sit here right now is a bit of a so what. I'd like to think that the creation of ICSs will lead to those clinicians perhaps doing something a bit different on a Monday morning, but right now it's a so what. But if we're talking about reform and the kind of messages to GPs that say, yeah, we know we told you to put everything to do everything remotely, and now we're telling you to switch right back again, that impacts on what GPs are doing on a day-to-day basis right now. So I think it the nature of the reform that's being talked about is quite important here.
Yeah, I think the tone of message is absolutely critical here, and it's cumulatively builds, and I think there's worrying signs of, so I've just been on a separate call, and people in the health service telling me that the level of abuse that they're now seeing, there's always been abuse in the health service, terrible as it is, but the level of abuse is actually rising much more. Now, some of this is to do with the fact that services have been closed and people are waiting longer, and it's frustrating. There's no excuse for it. But at the same time, you don't want to find a situation where you're basically pitching a service against the public, and managing that tension is really, really critical. And I think if we go back to the, you know, stay at home, protect the NHS, that message was very effective in a very short time frame. But what it did, I think, is it built up a kind of quid pro quo trade, which basically said, we're going to stay away to protect the NHS, and now the NHS needs to be open for me. And because of the range of different ways in which this backlog manifests itself, not just in numbers on a list, but you've got social backlog, workforce pressures, that's creating a series of big tensions. And how the government picks its way through those tensions and balances those is, I think, really, really important, because workforce is going to be critical to the recovery. And if people start leaving and we have got retention problems, then things are only going to get worse. So I think that the tone of messaging here is really, really critical as we go through what's going to be an even more difficult time.
I think that's such a good point about the idea that we're owed something from the NHS because of that kind of dialogue during the pandemic. The amount of conversations I've had with family who are so furious they can't see their GP, and it's funny how that is the thing that's sort of filtered through. I was also wondering about the kind of I suppose the rhetoric around GPs will be punished for not seeing enough patients face to face, and how that could impact the future pipeline of GPs. And there's a lot of talk, obviously, recruitment, domestic recruitment is a massive priority and hugely challenging, calls for more medical places and obviously the need for training places. But I just think it seems inevitable that it will make people not want to do it, because it is quite a damaging line to take.
Frankly, it's a challenge for international recruitment as well.
Yeah, so, I mean,
we've just done a piece of work on international nurse recruitment, and in many ways, and we know that the NHS is going to rely on bringing people in from overseas to plug workforce gaps for quite some time to come. We also know that one of the things which is a barrier to, and this piece of work was focused on nurses, but there's no reason why it shouldn't apply to other professional groups as well, a barrier to people wanting to come and work in the UK is the experience they think they're going to have, and where people feel they're going to be discriminated against and not valued by their leaders. Why would they come here? There are quite a lot of other places where English-speaking healthcare professionals can go and work.
I think it's sort of the GP ones, it's always a kind of interesting, like, you know, a good example, there is reform, there are many different types of reform, and there's kind of, you know, each one is a slightly different conversation and relationship with the workforce. And actually, you kind of accidentally fall into these rows, didn't you? You know, I'm not sure, you know, Jeremy Hunt, did he really want a row with the junior doctors? You know, he probably decided he was going to go for it once he got to a certain point. But, and with GPs, you know, I don't really think Javid, you know, want to have a row with GPs for the sake of it, and neither does NHS England, yet here they are both kind of fronting up to them, really. And I've just written a thing about that, and actually I don't think it's that unreasonable what NHS England and government have done, given the place they're in. They've just had to, but they just sort of like wound up there and realized there's no other way out of the situation when the profession is kind of furious about anything that happens, frankly, and unless they just kind of basically nothing is asked and more is given, and more workforce, which nobody has that sort of the kind of magic lever to bring more workforce quickly. And then on the other side, you know, the main biggest newspapers, you know, including the Times, which is not sort of like it's not the Daily Mail, is kind of raising this issue of access consistently, as are like charities. Health Watch, you know, is pretty clear it's a big problem. I don't know about Helen about National Voices, which she chair, but you know, it clearly there's an issue. And expectations, like you've said, you know, the public's expectations are huge going into winter. You know, do need to sort of have a little look at GP access. So I'm not sure if it's intentional, I'm not sure anyone really wants to be in this route about this particular reform, but here they are doing it. Bounced by events.
On the whole, I don't think it's intentional. I think there might be some times when people do decide that they're going to be a little bit challenging. But no,
this thing about briefing again, isn't it? It's sort of, well, why do you need to go and wind up the press? And I suppose it's because they want to try and take the point. They want to try and get those newspapers to back off by saying, look, we are doing something tough, actually. But
I don't know if anybody saw the tweet from Steve Russell shortly after the Messenger review was announced, where I'm paraphrasing because I haven't got it in front of me, but the gist of what he was saying is, you know, I don't mind people taking a look and saying, can we do something better? What I mind is the implication that we don't care. And I think, you know, if you talk to GPs, if you talk to nurses, if you talk to managers, if you talk to chief execs, 999 out of 1,000 of them care about doing a good job and care about meeting the needs of patients and people who use services. They will, you know, 998 out of 1,000 of them will also recognise that there are things they could do better. But what they want to do is to have people work with them in a way that acknowledges that they care and acknowledges they want to do better, rather than says, we think, again, I'm paraphrasing, but we think you're being lazy, we think you're not bothered about this, we think you want to take
I suppose it's worth asking Richard as well about that, because I think it's quite an important part of this thing where the new health secretary comes in. They've actually had nothing to do with the health service, really, but by and large in the past, apart from he had some scissors stuck inside him when he was a kid, didn't he? But as in the story that Sajid tells, but people, particularly, you know, conservatives, being frank about it, there are plenty of pieces and perceptions about the NHS being quite inefficient, about NHS management being quite inefficient, about why doesn't it reform more quickly. I think it's some people are genuinely surprised about the fact that actually most people, particularly leaders in the NHS, are actually quite up for reform, you know, in many senses. Do you think, Richard, there is a sort of I think there is a jarring, particularly with the discussion about money as well, because often the conversations do quite quickly turn to, yeah, well, we need some more money if you want us to do that. And there is a big problem with perception of that in parts of the Conservative Party and other parts of government and things when it comes to the NHS. So I wondered if you could talk to us about that, Richard. Obviously, yes. Yourself was involved. You were involved in the health service before you became a special advisor to Matt, but that's often not the case.
So I think there's a couple of things. This one is going back to the messenger stuff, and I think Adam sort of raised this, which was what do we mean by leadership? How do we define that? And are we actually really talking about management as well? And I think for a Conservative health secretary, it's very difficult to come in and saying, you know, I want more management in the health service, because exactly as you've said, Dave, the perception is there's a lot of management that isn't working effectively, which is not true actually. And actually, if you look at the 2012 reforms, one of the big weaknesses of those reforms was the anti-management approach of the reforms, because you need managers to deliver the reform. You're going to reform stuff, you need management to do it and coordinate it and drive it forward and set strategy and all of those things which probably get labelled as bureaucracy. So the messenger review, I think, will be about elements of, yes, leadership culture and some of that sort of setting stuff, which actually Dido Harding and others in the NHS have been focusing on for the last sort of few years and trying to get some of that right. But also we are going to see, I think, a focus on, you know, productivity, efficiency, and some of those areas. Again, this levy coming through from the Treasury, you would expect that to be part of the focus in terms of how we do things more effectively and better. The long-term plan has 5 Treasury tests in it, of course. Any system, any company, any organisation can, of course, probably drive greater levels of productivity and or efficiency. I think the interesting thing from COVID perspective, of course, is that what we found was our health system didn't have enough resilience in it, because actually we'd taken out some of the, because we'd actually driven an efficiency-based agenda. I mean, he remembers Quip, of course, from the early 2000s and 2010, driving that innovation and productivity and change-based agenda. So I do think there's this thing about, what are we talking about? We're talking about leadership, but are we actually also probably talking about management and how we manage the system? I think we probably are, but politically we don't say that. And yes, I think there's going to be a big focus on productivity and ways of working. However, just finally on that, spending review obviously coming out in the next few days, if you're going to deliver some of these uplifts and improvements and things like productivity, you are talking primarily about capital, workforce, investment. You need those things to drive the improvement and the change. If those things are lacking, you're not going to be able to, if you don't have connected health records, if you don't have staff in the right place, you're not going to be able to do things. So,
I agree, but I think sometimes when people come afresh to involvement in health and social care, and particularly if they've been in other departments and things, they kind of think, hang on a minute, we just gave you 30 billion or whatever the figure was, and of course it takes quite a long time for people to understand that, well, yeah, but health spending grows, there is an inbuilt inflation, which you're going to have to accept. And then, you know, if you want to do reforms on top of that, then there's more money. We all kind of know that's the case. But
if you're not careful, you can give lots of money inefficiently as well. So I do appreciate that Jeremy Hunt has quite explicitly talked about some of his learning in his time as the health secretary. And in my time in Monaco, I spent quite a bit of time in his office when we were working on urgent care. And I do remember,
was this when you were scraping together it was 750 million or something, wasn't it? I need a winter fund and you need to find it. Yeah, I remember that. Got the scoop actually. Yeah, when I'm back in my mod.
He was really keen to understand how many doctors and nurses this money was buying. And I understood that because, you know, actually doctors and nurses deliver clinical care and it plays out well in the Daily Mail headlines. I did think, and I was not brave enough to say it to his face, I'll admit, that actually investing money in some good data analytics so that we could actually understand what was happening to people would probably give us more of a benefit. And I really take Richard's point about the value of management as well as leadership. If I think back to some of the things, they are reforms, they're not legislative reforms, but reforms which made the biggest difference to patients, the modernisation agency approach is one of those. Now, it did come in at a time when there was a lot more money as well, and that helped. But actually what they did was work with managers at a range of levels to make sure that people really understood process, and they really got process right, and they got it right from the patient perspective as well as the trust perspective. And that makes, you know, that actually makes a much better use of resources as well as much better patient experience.
Do you think, one thing I was wondering yesterday was, there's obviously a big public inquiry due to happen into COVID. I don't know how long it'll take. There's expectation about how long it'll take, but is that going to play into NHS reform, do you think, and NHS health and social care reform, and kind of knock the whatever plans the current health social care secretary might have, is sort of knock them sideways? Or is it, do we think it's going to be more about sort of public health and prepare? I mean, that's a slightly absurd thing to try and predict, but it is a big thing in the health and social care landscape over the next year or so that we should flag up.
Yeah, to Richard's point about resilience and capital, it's absolutely right. And just thinking about what Steve Powers said about, you know, actually hospitals should be single rooms. Well, you know, I know that there are arguments, you know, both for and against that, but it's definitely worth exploring. But we have a very old, on average, hospital estate. So actually, if we are going to shift to single room or even smaller room accommodation, that requires a massive capital injection, which is simply not going to happen. But you know, actually, from a point of view of infection prevention and control, the fabric of our estate may well turn out to have had as big an impact on hospital acquired infection as the availability of PPE.
Potentially around health inequalities and the way that the health service and public health, but also the health system does its relationship with people of different ethnicities and different.
Well, I was thinking about health-acquired infection, but
yeah. I was kind of separate point, just thinking about stuff that might come into the inquiry. But yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating that actually these beds that have been taken out, if at all possible, they're just going to put them back in, even though that comes with a well-known infection risk.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things on the inquiry. One is, I think it's going to be a long game. I think it's going to be wide ranging and large in scope. I would probably say take quite a long time. It will divert attention in certain bits of government because these things require preparation and people to engage with them properly. So that is a kind of, and that time piece is something about central government in particular in recent years. I mean, I think you guys at HSJ highlighted the sort of increases in staff recently, DH and NHS England, for obvious reasons given the pandemic. But even before the pandemic, central functions were rising in staff because of Brexit. And the amount of work that people at the top of government are dealing with in some of these very complex, multifaceted agendas is actually very, very substantial. The inquiry will just add to that workload against other things, and I obviously very much support a full and thorough public inquiry, but it does divert attention from, you know, delivering some of the changes in the system. And then it's, what impact do any of those recommendations and engagements have on our healthcare system? And I think it was well documented by, you know, Helen Nuffield and others before the pandemic that we don't spend probably as much as we do on health. We run our system too hot, and the solutions to that are, you know, in a publicly funded healthcare system, I'd probably find ways to inject more different elements of public funding and work in slightly different ways. We're doing some of that with integrated care systems. We're seeing some of that with the levy. But I think the interesting debate we're not having, which is politically not going to happen, is, you know, a health funding debate about where do we raise funding. If we are going to system, if we are going to want the workforce we need, if we are going to pay for some of these new technologies and all these other things, is there's how much bandwidth can we get out of the system? I don't think that debate is going to be had between now and the next election, but I think it is a constraint having it on actually delivering some change that you may want to see ultimately down the line. So I think the inquiry will do a couple of things. It will divert some attention away from some of this delivery, and then it will kick off some kind of discussions about the service and service change. But this will be in the medium term.
I think just on that last point around kind of bandwidth in the service, just kind of something to end on really, but how do you balance trying to reform and then also prioritising recovery? Because he might have had an easier job if 2022 had been his year of recovery, because that is kind of what the health service needs. How do you do both at the same time?
I It's been interesting, some of the pieces of work that we've been doing in the Nuffield Trust, talking to leaders in ICSs in a couple of regions and talking about the kind of rhetoric around recovery and restoration. And actually, a lot of people are saying we don't want restoration. We don't want what we had before. We want it to be different. And actually, we start playing with words like recovery and revolution and so on. So people do want things to be different. And they've, in a slightly paradoxical way, they've had a good experience during the pandemic of being able to do things differently. And almost that mission command approach to say, here's your resources, here's your outcome, you go and work out how to do it. And people have tried things and failed and tried them differently, and it's worked. And people have enjoyed that experience despite all the pressures they're in. So I think it's something about the tone and the rhetoric that wraps around it that actually enables people. People know that they need to address the backlog, you know, they're not blind to it, but actually enables them to think creatively about how they do it without being instructed from on high. Because one of the things that we've learned, you kind of know it anyway, but one of the things we're really clear about from Nuffield when we do our evaluations is you need to understand why something worked as well as whether it worked or not. Because you can very rarely just lift and shift something from one place to another. If you understand what made it work, you can understand how to adapt for a different context.
I think the slow introduction of ideas, if they are quite radical, is quite important, isn't it? You can see that with the sort of forward view change, you know, trying to like drip feed ideas in like accountable care and things like that. And then gradually over the years, you know, they certainly tripped up a few times as well. But over the years, people became more accustomed to it. Sorry, Richard.
Yeah, I just think on 2020 being year of reform, and I think reform is such an awful Whitehall treasury word, which doesn't really connect to those who are having to deliver the services. And I think Helen's absolutely right in terms of people have found working differently quite empowering. They've had to work collaboratively. They've had to make quicker decisions. Trying to lock some of that change mechanism in, I think, could be a really positive legacy from the pandemic. The danger is you try and impose reform from a place which is disconnected from that change, and it just doesn't land as effectively. And I think health policy in this country is always a tension between the centre and the local. And actually, we've, I think, made real strides in the last 10 years about trying to move towards more localised, collaborative, place-based approaches. The slight danger over the course of the pandemic, and actually ever since a certain individual put the NHS on the side of a red bus in 2016, is that we've seen a migration perhaps to more centralisation of certain powers. We've now got much more beefed up teams in number 10 and number 11, and a new Secretary of State with new ideas. And the danger is that tension creates difficulties for actually delivering what patients and the public really, really need, rather than everyone working together. So I think 2020 is a year of reform, brings, yes, opportunities to do things differently, but also really real risks and potential difficulties if it's done badly.
We should give a little promo for the HSJ 100 published yesterday, I believe, which identified exactly this, that the government has talked about wanting to deliver the need for public services and other parts of government to deliver, which is absolutely right. And sometimes reform dovetails with delivery, but sometimes it works against it and distracts from it. And in this case, it seems like government, at the moment, it feels like government's kind of coming with quite a lot of ideas about how it wants to reform rather than to simply encourage delivery closer to the front line.
I think that's a very good point to close this week. Thank you so much for joining me. And just a reminder to listeners, our podcast is available every week on our website and across all main podcast channels. Please don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next week.